Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast.
We recorded this on November 10th, 2016, and you're listening to Episode 8.
Politicoast is the podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and around the country. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or wherever you found this podcast, and make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at PoliticoastPod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. Let's go briefly into the Conservative leadership debate. I didn't end up getting a chance to watch it. It ran for 2 hours and there was the 15 people on there, so they only each talked for like 30 seconds. But you watched it, so give me your sort of top line thoughts on how you think it went.
There was no real kind of standout, this is the clear front runner to emerge from it. The 12 people on stage and the 40-second answer format that necessarily entails made it kind of hard to get much more of a sense beyond the kind of top-level sound bites from each campaign. So I'm not sure this is really going to help narrow the field at all. Big standouts, though, Deepak O'Brien went from a who to somebody who got a fair bit of attention for his answers, came out really strong on the Canadian identity issue. For the record, he's a immigrant born in Africa, has lived in Europe and now Canada, member of the Stephen Harper government, and is quoted as saying, "I don't give two hoots about the niqab." Clearly doesn't want to touch the whole immigration issues at all. Came out strong, passionate about a lot of stuff, surprisingly funny, and had some interesting thoughts on the climate file. Besides everyone else who was either criticizing carbon taxes, the one guy who was supporting carbon taxes, and everybody else who was sucking up to carbon capture, he was proposing nuclear waste recycling, using energy generated by that, expanding the nuclear sector. So there's some interesting ideas there that don't typically get a lot of play in Canadian politics.
Yeah, and if the Conservatives wanted to do as sharp of a turn from the image of Stephen Harper, Deepak O'Brien sounds like the sort of perfect candidate to encapsulate multicultural Canada from a Conservative angle.
Either him or Michael Chaun. They're the two kind of standout candidates on that stage who can really, I think, physically embody the diverse party they in theory want to build, and at least some of them are pretty explicit in their intent with that, those two being the obvious examples. They're both running on a "I'm going to broaden the party's appeal" message.
Of course, one thing you were telling me is a lot of people on that stage went after Kelly Leach, obviously, because she brought forward the Canadian values idea, and I did see one poll in the last week that had her at the head of this busy field. Of course, that's saying she has support of 17% of people and the runner-ups have 12%. So it's not a huge lead. And on a ranked ballot, unlike the U.S. primaries, she needs a lot of second choices to make her go over the top, if that were where she was right now. How do you think she did last night?
She hit the talking points. Not very charismatic. Didn't really sell them. It will appeal to the Trump supporters and people who are sympathetic to that. Spent a whole lot of time talking about how she's going to be all buddy-buddy with the new president down there, and because they have similar interests, including screening. Those were the exact words, "I have similar interests, including screening," that kept getting repeated again.
There's nothing like more coded you can just say to be like, "I am the Trump candidate," than saying, without saying that.
Yes.
Than that.
I'm actually surprised she didn't promise to build a wall almost. So yeah, Kelly Leach, yeah, she'll appeal to the segment that she appeals to. I'm not sure she did anything to broaden her base at all that night. Same thing with Steve Blaney, who's also running on that platform. Did get a little more passionate on a few issues, but that was mostly supply management of all things, which is kind of the wonkiest of the wonk economic policies.
But among the Conservative circles, supply management is either their, like, boogeyman that they're all really bitter about, or the, like, thing that keeps farmers paid.
Yeah.
So they all care a lot.
Yes.
In a nerdy way.
Yeah, and that's actually one thing to really like about this campaign that's going on, is how much supply management's kind of come up as that. Maxime Bernier has been running on this, and that was actually one of the first big policies he put out, which is a little odd in that sense, because it is such a wonky thing, but it absolutely is something that really energizes, but at least gets the kind of free marketers juices going and kind of gets them a little riled up on it, even if it doesn't really appeal to a broad base on that. But, you know, it's about as anti-free market as you can get. It's raising prices on staple goods for everybody. And it's the sort of thing that people like Maxime Bernier should absolutely hate and kind of do. In terms of some of the others, Lisa Raitt came into this kind of as one of the big names, but honestly seemed pretty bland in the whole thing. Didn't really do anything to sell herself at all as a candidate.
I'm trying to think back if, and I don't remember at all because I didn't watch it at the time, but wonder how Harper did in his sort of first candidate debates. Did he just kind of show up? Because I can't picture him being charismatic, because he's like almost getting it at the end there. In his like final election debates, he'd finally learned how to almost appear human. His like first ones, I can only imagine the robotic nerd who went on
Harper stage. Did better among a friendly audience. But yeah, he was never the most charismatic. And if one thing his prime ministership proved is you don't need charisma to be successful in politics.
So I'm almost wondering if Lisa Raitt has the same sort of just go on your resume rather than your sort of.
And that was charm. Really what she hit on a lot was her time in cabinet.
And Cape Breton, you said.
Oh, yes. The two things I took away from that is she's a Cape Breton who was in cabinet.
Well, that's the first thing they teach you about public speaking. If you want to be effective, make sure people take away the minimum number of points. I don't know if those are the two I'd go for if I were her, but I guess she's now got the Cape Breton vote and those who care about cabinet members becoming prime ministers.
Yes, but there's a lot of other former cabinet ministers on that stage. I'm not really sure how much that'll set her apart. On the more BC side of things, a couple things came up. One is softwood lumber was an issue a lot of people touched on, especially in the context of trade, and how that's something any new prime minister is going to have to really pressure the Americans on. And that's, of course, BC's largest export to the U.S. is lumber. So look forward to seeing that come up in campaign stops here, and potentially 2019, if that's still an ongoing problem then, as it almost certainly will be, especially with the new anti-trade president coming in.
Well, and softwood lumber has been a perpetual issue over 30 years of BC politics. It'll just keep coming up because there's always disagreements.
Yes, of course. And only one person on that stage out of the 12 was from BC. Andrew Satston, former MP, lost his seat in the last election. He's from North Vancouver. Honestly, didn't really stand out that much. Fairly bland, typical conservative. Hit all the common talking points, but not particularly charismatic and nothing interesting on policy
side. So there's a very high chance he is the token West Coaster, just so when he resigns or he quits the race, he can pass his supporters. He can't pass his supporters, but he can direct them and he can get them signed up.
Yes. At this point, there's nothing clear on where he'd be directing them.
Well, maybe that's what he's in the race for, is just to figure out where he wants to tie his horse to see if he can get a future political appointment or something.
And finally, as we kind of touched on a bit with our previous talk of the Washington State Carbon Tax Initiative, BC came up again from Michael Chong in there as a model to follow on carbon taxes. We talked a lot about in the last episode. He's really hitting that point as that's kind of one of his signature planks. He took a lot of heat from it because everybody else was against carbon taxes on that stage. But he absolutely held up the BC model as the one to follow. Went as far as basically listing off every other jurisdiction's climate policies in Canada with a, this is not how you do it, follow BC.
And did he manage to hold his own against the onslaught against him?
Yeah, I think he held up fairly well. And admittedly, I'm a little biased on this one, but I think he generally performed pretty well on stage.
I guess the question will come down to how many people actually watch this debate who aren't just journalists and wonks like us, and how many of those are conservative voters.
Yeah, he was one of the more energized on stage and definitely projected that somewhat wonky vibe, but not in an uncharismatic, nerdy professor way. And I think, you know, probably 60-75% of all the figures and numbers that were tossed out on that stage came from him.
well, hopefully if it doesn't end up between him and Kelly Leach, that the climate plan is what sinks him. Because I could see a lot of conservative supporters and members saying they would never support a carbon plan, carbon tax, because they don't believe in climate change. And they could naturally fall to her. But maybe there'll be a third one who's in there, and it'll be sort of the two anti-Kelly Leaches and her.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be the first time parties come around on an issue. The Conservative Party used to be anti-free trade back well before, like in the 70s and earlier. And they came around kind of shortly before Mulroney showed up. And it wouldn't be out of the question for them to come around on this. It's a little less likely because the opposition's also staked out that ground. But there is a pretty solid conservative argument for carbon taxes. And there is room to make that broader appeal to the economic conservatives in the room.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eye on it. And maybe I'll even get a chance to watch the debate if it's still streamed online over the weekend. The next big story, which wasn't supposed to be a big story today, was that the Supreme Court of Canada held its hearings in the British Columbia Teachers Federation versus the government of BC's sort of ongoing litigation over contract disputes and back to work laws. So they had the arguments in the morning, and somewhere between 30 minutes and an hour later, the judges came back and said, no, we're siding with BCTF 7-2. And we don't know more than that because they haven't issued a full written ruling yet. But the fact they came back so quickly, I'd never really heard of that happening at the Supreme Court level, except maybe in such clear-cut cases.
Which is a little odd, because typically they won't take such a clear-cut case.
Well, it's because the BC Court of Appeal had sided with the government of BC. So there was something glaringly incorrect in that ruling that we'll have to sort of go back and look at, and really look forward to this written decision when this written decision comes out, because that will actually tell us what this means. Because right now, what this basically dates back to is previous contract disputes between the BCTF and the government, when the government legislated away the union's right to negotiate over class size and composition. And since then, the government has essentially allowed class sizes to grow and required teachers to take on more students with special needs, which my wife is a teacher, and that's very difficult because if a student requires more time, that's less for everyone else. Obviously, it's simple math. And so teachers are celebrating today, but it's a big question mark of what does this mean for the past sort of 10 years of time, because this is tens of millions of dollars per year per district across the province that needs to be made up.
Yes, we don't have exact numbers yet, but it's estimated it's going to be about $1 billion to bring things back to the 2002 levels, which was when that was first introduced, that legislation that limited bargaining rights. So that's going to definitely take a hit, or that's definitely going to be a hit for the BC Liberals, because that wipes out any contingency they had in their last budget, and depending on how well resource prices do, which it's a big question mark, and of course the ensuing economic collapse brought out by Donald Trump.
And I mean, gold's going to do fine because everything in America is going to be paid in gold, but we don't have that much here in BC.
Yeah, so it's to definitely hurt them in the budget when they have to come out with their next update prior to the election. They don't find a way to push that back, but there's a good chance they're going to be coming into the next election in a deficit if they can't find a little money elsewhere, which honestly I think is more likely if they're going to shuffle some money around to try and keep things budget.
It's all going to come down to what the written decision says, but I know there's a lot of cynicism in the BC Ed sector, and this all comes back to Christy Clark because she was education minister at the time when this all happened, so she wears this entire legacy and will wear this legacy going into the election, which makes it really interesting. So there's this possibility that they could just try to relitigate this or argue it a different way. I don't know if they could take it back to court because it's the Supreme Court of Canada ruling, which is sort of the highest court in Canada. But this is a government that reached a contract with the BCTF in 2014 following a labor dispute. And they may just try to argue that's all they need to follow now. But the BCTF sure as fuck is going to argue we have this new ruling on our side. that says we can negotiate these other terms that aren't in our current contract. And so I guess it all comes down for me to this, what this ruling actually says.
Yes, it's hardly unprecedented in Canadian history for a government to suffer a defeat in the courts, make a few minor tweaks that don't really get to the root of the issue, and the whole thing has to be relitigated again.
That is exactly this issue, I'm pretty sure, because I'm sure the BCTF has taken them to court over this exact issue twice now.
They have, and it's unlikely. It typically doesn't go a third time, but who knows? With this government, it wouldn't surprise me.
And so I guess my next, two questions are obviously, how does this play to the public? And sort of how do the political parties play this to the public? I know the BC Liberals, I think they love the idea of fighting the unions because it makes them, it appeals to their base. Their base wants to see that sort of center-right, right-wing base in BC wants to see the sort of unions rolled back a bit. This is a defeat for that, but I could see that just funneling anger and frustration back into the BC Liberals rather than, people will now suddenly realize you can't just legislate away rights without actually trying a good faith effort to negotiate.
Yes, and there's definitely a perception that the BC NDP is too close to unions, and I don't know how much there's likely to be a backlash on it. The BC Teachers Federation is fairly popular, but there can definitely be cases in BC politics where that closeness can hurt the NDP.
For sure. The BC NDP wants to break, the corporate union donations in BC like they just did in Alberta, but for now they're accepting union money because they need to have equal money to fight the BC Liberals. We talked about how the BC Greens aren't going to take any of that money, but that's a really easy thing to do when you're third or fourth party.
And it's not just the money, though. Is the NDP actually reserve votes in their interim party voting process for unions. And that's always been a bit of a sticking point for me. And besides some policy disagreements, is one of the reasons why I'd be very reluctant to ever join the party, is because of that, explicitly having an interest group as voting members of the party. I mean, I think we'd all object to the Conservative Party having, the Center of Commerce or a church have voting rights in the party and be pretty skeptical of that and kind of see it the same way.
You have to remember, this is British Columbia too, where at the municipal level, they allowed corporations to vote until only a few years ago. So there's all kinds of weird biases that can exist. The NDP reaction so far is what I've seen. John Horgan has said, where's Mike Bernier's response? Because the education minister hasn't actually put out a response yet. He might have by the time I get this posted. But I did see him give a sort of Twitter reply when someone asked where he was. And he's like, I'm flying back to my riding where the NDP would never even dare to visit, which is the most sort of typical, let's switch this to hyper-partisan BC education fight that it sort of always devolves to. I guess what's more interesting for me in the longer term, the BC NDP is probably celebrating this victory from the Supreme Court for the union. But the NDP, when they come to power, have to deal with these same issues. They will come up against unions that want more because they figure they can get more from an NDP government than they can from a Liberal government. But then they still have the same fiscal constraints, so they try and pull back. And that was the big issue in the 90s and in the Bob Rae government in Ontario, is you have this even more bitter almost fight because it's, the fight among friends and family members rather than the fight with your opponents.
Yeah, and that's one thing the opposition parties always hit on whenever the NDP are likely to come into power and have to negotiate one of those contracts too. So this it'll probably overall help them, but there's definitely lines of attack against the NDP embedded in this. But this, of course, depends on how it all shakes out, and we don't have the final ruling yet.
So the biggest winner all that we can say right now is Andrew Weaver, because he's got no stake in the game.
Yes, but it gives him a way to attack the current government.
Exactly, he can attack everyone. Well, let's move into a couple quick stories to wrap up the episode.
Okay, so the BC Liberals held their convention here in Vancouver. Overall, not a huge amount came out of it, which is probably the sign of a good convention when you're a party in power. Typically, they only make the news when there's someone's getting hired or fired or some big policy comes out of it.
Or the grassroots fringe, like, explodes and
yes.
gets their crazy voices heard again.
Yeah, the recent federal NDP one, that got a lot of attention, both because of the LEAP manifesto getting adopted and Thomas Mulcair is unceremoniously getting kicked out, though he's still around. But this one here, not a huge amount came out of it. The one thing that did catch a little bit of attention is the party did vote 81% to encourage ride-sharing services in the province and adopt legislation to enable that.
And that's the idea of supporting companies like Uber and Lyft to operate in BC, because currently we're the only place in North America where there isn't Uber. And there's arguments for and against that, and probably with a good legislation scheme, there's no reason we can't have it here.
Yes,
our taxis are terrible.
And in fact, Uber's said one of the reasons they haven't pushed the boundaries so much is they view this as one of the jurisdictions that's most amenable to a legislative compromise on the issue. And I think we've seen the first steps of it on the government side here.
And of course, things that get passed at policy conventions are even less and less likely these days to make it to platforms or into government. I think this will. The Greens have also adopted a similar position, and I don't think even the NDP would long-term oppose the idea of, you know, overhauling the taxi industry, because I don't know many people who are like, damn, taxis are amazing, because every time I ride in one in Vancouver, I'm white-knuckling and feel like I'm going to die. And then I have to pay them $60 for that experience.
Somebody just has to deal with them as another car on the road. They're terrible.
But otherwise, this convention didn't really generate much news. The news that came out all talked about it being upbeat. I saw some people's videos and vlogs saying they went there and it was a very welcoming, happy experience. And that's all really good news for Christy Clark and probably bad news for the BC NDP that are looking for wedge issues or internal party disarray. A united, happy, excited party, particularly one that's able to have a good convention like this, you know, shortly out from their next election, is in probably pretty good position.
Yeah, they've definitely got a little long in the tooth just from how long they've been in power, but they haven't seemed to really hit that point where they've started to come apart and just have no energy anymore. Which I guess is kind of actually impressive for someone who's been in this long, but we'll have to see once the election gets off.
Well, and you have to remember, Christy Clark is an amazing campaigner. She, you know, swept the Liberal leadership when no one thought she would, and she had very little caucus support. She won the previous election when no one thought she would. The only campaign she really lost was the HST referendum.
Well, she did lose her seat here in Vancouver Point Grey.
That's true.
And that was actually a little embarrassing for her, because then she had to go find a safe seat and run as in a by-election.
The other news this week is Prince Edward Island technically voted for electoral reform, specifically the multi-member plurality system, where you can go back and listen to our deep dive on electoral reform to learn all about that. It was a plebiscite that's not binding, but it's possible the province could go that way.
Yes, there were 5 options on the board for this one. First past the post, mixed member proportional, instant runoff, first past the post plus party leaders, where the party leaders also get a seat, regardless of whether or not they would have won one by themselves, and dual member proportional, which is basically a variant of mixed member proportional. This one was, and instant runoff voting. This one was decided actually with an instant runoff counted method. It was a ranked ballot. And even though first past the post got the most initial votes, by the time all the eliminations were done and the instant runoffs were calculated, MMP came out ahead. But the premier's already kind of walking back from the other side. There's a low turnout of basically 35%. It was not a huge mismember proportional. It didn't sweep into the obvious one right off the bat.
It only won on the last ballot. First pass, I saw the breakdown of sort of step by step.
Which we'll link to in the show notes.
And it was only on the last sort of counting that first past the post didn't win. So it was sort of the default choice for most people, but everyone else managed to come around from behind. And we sort of talked about one of the issues with the sort of alternative vote style of ranking ballots is you get these come from behind victories where no one's really happy.
Yeah. On the other hand, instant runoff actually isn't that bad a system when you only have to select one outcome. It's actually pretty good for that overall. And I think in this case, that's especially true where you have a lot of people who are grouped together, but have minor variations in what their top line preferences. So we'll have a lot of people who absolutely don't want first past the post, but there's, you know, a dozen different opinions on what's the best system to replace that. And there's, I think, a pretty solid argument there that a ranked ballot with a runoff is a better way to encapsulate it. Because if you had just run first past the post on it, where everyone got the top line, most votes, it wouldn't have really represented where everyone was, which, of course, is the main problem with the system.
But the biggest issue with this, of course, is that really low voter turnout. And that's so critical here because PEI has really good voter turnout in every other election. They'll get 80% of people voting in the federal elections. And this they made as easy as possible, as far as I understand. They had the ballot available by mail. As far as I know, you could vote online. You could go to polling places and things were open for weeks. It wasn't like the one day election, as far as I know. And all of that only drove the turnout a few more percent higher than the last time they had a referendum on this question when it was only about 30%. So it's almost just people didn't care, I guess, which then doesn't really grant the premier the mandate to push it forward if that's what he went to this plebiscite for.
Yes, though I do think this is interesting that it does show that you can win on a referendum for reform. A lot of the arguments I've seen put out there against having a referendum for the national level reform we're doing is that it's, you know, a way to kill the initiative. You know, there'll be all this misinformation. You can't pass it, and this is just going to be a way to kill it. This shows that that's not necessarily the case. And in fact, we've had a few results recently where the intended outcome, so to speak, didn't actually end up happening.
I wonder if the referendum also would have done a lot better if they tied it to a general election, which is what you usually see happen, is people then are going in to vote for the president or their member of parliament or their MLA, and then they just have to do one more check.
Yeah, well, is a way to drive up turnout, but at the same time, you also get that priming problem that we were talking about earlier. And in that case, do you want how they answer the question on this to be in the context of what they thought about the current government?
Well, the other problem you get there is related to that mandatory voting issue we talked about, where then just everyone's sort of voting and maybe you want just the people who've taken the time to learn about the system to vote. And not to say there should be a test to vote. It's just we want an informed electorate. Finally, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau visited BC last week, just before the US election, to announce a $1.5 billion ocean spill responses plan. And this was big news because a couple weeks ago we had a tug sink off the BC coast and spill diesel fuel into the coastline. And then we've had another crash since then where gravel barge, I believe, flipped over and dumped its load into the sea. So it's a timely issue, but it's definitely a partisan one where it raises a lot of questions about, is this enough? Is he looking at the right things or what strings are tied to it?
Yes, and this is famously one of the conditions that Kirsty Clark put on having a pipeline to the West Coast was the having a world-class spill response. And this is definitely speaks to that. I think this is probably going to be the opening salvo towards approving a pipeline when the next decision's due for the Trans Mountain pipeline to Burnaby, BC. most likely what's going on here is that they're making the initial moves to allay the fears about spills prior to approving the pipeline.
So we'll definitely keep our eye on that to see, because we expect a decision on that pipeline very soon by the end of the year. And we'll see. Maybe this spill response will be enough to allay the public's fears. I doubt many environmentalists are considering this enough.
Yeah, well, I think, especially in the environmental community, you're going to be hard-pressed to find anything that's enough. But the question, I think, is more the general public, whether it'll win over them. And that has been Politicoast. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, at PoliticoastPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.